to it, so it can't reflect it. It can burn it up in heat, and if it does, you're going to feel that heat with your hand real fast. The third thing you can do with the energy you put into it is it radiates it into space. So you put 10 watts or 100 watts in an antenna, and you do it for 10 minutes, and if you get no Vizwan and no reflected energy, and it runs ice cold, it did radiate it into space. The law of reciprocity says, however the antenna behaves on transmit, gain, pattern, standing wave ratio, beam width, all the things you can measure, however it behaves on transmit, with rare exceptions, it's got to behave the exact same way on reception. So if you have doubt, you can confirm it with the heat test. If it passes the heat test, it's got the efficiency, it's got the gain. All you got to do is aim it in the right direction in three-dimensional space, set it up for the right polarization, put it at the right altitude, and you're off and running. It's got to go. It has no choice. It's equivalent to saying every time I drop that brick, gravity will pull it down the ground. It's got to go. That's my strongly felt opinion, Mel. KQKY, KQLIW.
I brought up a very good point. It says KQKY. Now, the receiving loop that I have is, I should say, a little less than 0.1 wavelength on 75 meters. It's made of one turn of coaxial cable. In other words, 12 feet of basic coax cable that I worked out the formulas he gave it. Well, basically, you know, he had showed in the antenna manual how to work it out for 160. He actually made that antenna because he had a problem with a broadcast station that was giving problems on 160, so he made this loop because he could null it out. And I find that this loop is extremely directive. You can't move this loop too much before you take a station and go from taking him to where he could be really, literally, as he said in the article, really null out a station. Now, the TAC antenna is a spiral of a lot of wire going around the 40-meter antenna, the two-quarter wavelength of the 40-meter antenna. Now, the loop that I'm working with is only one turn of coax. Well, like I say, it worked out the coax that measure the distributed capacitance and so on and so forth, and so you get a range of the size variable capacity you need to resonate it on. Now, what would you call the difference that I'm using, like I say, I'm only consisting of 12 feet of one turn where it is. Most likely if you stretched it out would come to about 30 plus feet of wire, about 33 feet of wire on each one of the TAC elements. So would there be an advantage if I could go ahead and build, well, I could make it, I'm sure there's no magic, build a 40-meter version, would I be better off if I made a 40-meter version with the one turn? Is there a magic something, formula or something that I'm missing between the method that he is applying and the method that I'm applying, Dick, over?
Okay. A person first looking at the TAC antenna and looking at the spiral at the end would say, gee, it looks a little bit like a cavity-backed spiral antenna, or without the cavity. And a spiral antenna does tend to issue circular polarization. So you could look at the TAC antenna and say, hey, that's got to be circular polarized. It's got to have a circular polarized component. At first you could say that, but there's a catch. He's got the exact same direction of spiral on the left side and the right side. They tend to cancel. In other words, as the signal goes out to the right-hand side, it goes into a right-hand spiral. If I'm standing on the, let's assume now that the antenna is aimed in such a way that it favors east-west, which means that the main piece of straight wire in the center is north-south. And I've got a clockwise turn on the southern end, and I've got a clockwise turn on the northern end. But if I look from the south, I'm now a southern signal reception device. And I look at the coil that's closest to me, it will appear to have the opposite turns as the one that is on the north side. When I looked through the first one as a transparent device and I look into the second one. Because of the symmetry, they are opposite in sense from any one direction. So the little bit of circular polarization that's being launched by that antenna is being primarily canceled. The majority of the radiation is the current that flows in the straight piece of wire that's between the two coils. That's what's favoring the east-west. So if I set it up with one coil north, one coil south, and a straight wire north-south, I am favoring east-west. And so, now, that spiral antenna, which is getting its bandwidth from a kind of distributed loading, from a kind of a top hat capacitor, the combination of the two. And what looks like circular polarization, but I say it is not. I think the CP component is going to be less than 10% of that radiation, in my opinion. If I now compare that to a loop made out of coax cable, which you've resonated, as long as you've got low resistance, obvious by passing the hot antenna test, the conservation of energy test, and as long as it's not reflecting the power back, because it passes the Boussoir test. So if the antenna in both cases runs cold, and if both antennas are smaller than half wavelength physical, which means you're into the realm of the infinitesimal dipole, it doesn't matter now whether it's a loop of wire favoring the H field or a TAC antenna favoring the E field. And because there is this tight relationship, once you know the magnitude of the E field, you know the magnitude of the H field. Exactly half the power at any one instant of time of that wave is in the E field, and half the power is in the H field. And whether you favor and decide to listen to the H field component or the E field component, because they're equal in power, it doesn't matter. They have to behave almost the same. Same amount of gain, same amount of beamwidth, and efficiency has to be nearly the same. Once you get into that realm of the so-called infinitesimal dipole, less than a half wavelength of length, where you have very little real estate left to do any real pattern control, beamwidth control, as long as they don't violate conservation of energy, they got to be the same, Mel, as long as you carry it out correctly. Now you're down to, are you using a good capacitor? Are you using low-loss resistance materials? Have you mounted it correctly? You're not mounting it on a piece of rubbery material that's got very high loss tensions at your frequency. In other words, the rubber acts like a dummy load. And your hot hand test will tell you that real fast. They got to behave almost the same in my mind. I think you see where I'm going with this now. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I see where you're going. The question is, K2KEY, by the way. Now my question will be, can you stack these antennas? In other words, can we combine, add to this system, stack or some configuration? And if so, they're so small, what would happen if we are able in some way to put them together in some configuration? They're so small that are we going to wind up with an antenna system that we're going to, the real banger that's going to get on the band, and the guy with the tower with the three element monster 40 meter beam all of a sudden is sitting back and saying, what the heck did I put all this fortune into, this huge amount of resources, and this guy here did it for a couple of maybe for $150-$200 because they sell them so cheap. So if you're going to say to me that now you can actually also add, make some kind of stacking arrangement or something, do you think that will be possible, or will they just not work, Nick, over?
The answer is almost no. Remember now, the one missing ingredient with most of us as we first study antennas is we completely forget about effective capture area. Every real antenna has an effective capture area. A full half-wave 80-meter dipole has that great big ellipse, that black ellipse in space, with the dipole in the center of it, 8,500 square feet. You make your infinitesimal dipole. I don't care if it's a TAC antenna, a small dipole with loading coils and zigzags and and top hat, or whether you build it as a small loop antenna. You make your infinitesimal dipole-like antenna, or infinitesimal wavelength-wide loop antenna, because it has nearly the same gain within half a dB. Within half a dB, it must have the exact same area, 8,500 square feet. You can stack these antennas, and it'll look as a beautiful structure, and you stack them 8 feet apart. 8 feet apart, where each individual antenna has 8,000 some odd square feet of area. Obviously, those areas are going to be 90% overlapping each other. Therefore, you're not going to get the improvement you think. So I can look at it as an area relationship, and your areas are drastically overlapping. You're not going to receive one signal. I can look at it from another point of view. Remember with my 24-inch diameter 10-gig dish, when I go 1.5 degrees off of foresight, because the dish is 24 inches wide, and since at 10 gigs the wavelength is 1 inch, the dish is 24 wavelengths wide. If I did that at 80 meters, it would be a mile and a half antenna, or something like that. 24 wavelengths, where each wavelength is 300 some odd feet. Wow. Almost 300 feet. 135 times 2, 270 feet. And multiply that by 24. It's a big number of feet. It's a couple of miles. So, my 24 wavelength dish, when I go 1.5 degrees off one side, the left-hand side of the dish has just moved a quarter wavelength closer to me. The right-hand side of the dish has just moved a quarter wavelength further away from me. The two, quarter wavelength four, closer, just 90 degrees closer, the right-hand side, 90 degrees further away, they're 180 degrees out of phase with each other. So the whole region of the left-hand side of the dish is radiating a beautiful signal toward me. The whole region of the right-hand side of the dish is radiating a beautiful signal toward me. But those two signals are 180 degrees out of phase. They cancel. So once you have a number of wavelengths of dimension to the antenna, you're now seeing the mechanism by which when you go up foresight, some of it gets closer, some of it gets further away. The number of wavelengths and geometry determine how soon those two areas are 180 degrees out of phase, and now you're beginning to get that first null between the main lobe and the first side lobe. The first side lobe is where those two sections have now moved a full half wavelength apart, left and right, and now they're 360 degrees away from each other in the back end phase. That's your first side lobe. So it takes real estate, it takes wavelength to narrow up the pattern. And you can't get gain without narrowing up the pattern. So there's got to be wavelength. So stacking antennas, until you stack antennas, I don't care what frequency you're on, I don't care how you build the antenna, until you stack the antennas roughly one-half wavelength apart for each individual element, until they're a half wavelength apart, you haven't done anything. You don't have the real estate to do the interferometry, to narrow up the pattern. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you haven't separated them far enough so that the affected areas are not drastically overlapping. Another way of looking at it. They both better give you the exact same answer, by the way.
In 2 MB.
Every real, Barry recognized, every real problem has got two or three ways of looking at it. And if you're smart enough to cross all the T's and dot all the I's, you better get the same answer in all three ways. So until you stack them a half wavelength, in my opinion, you're wasting your time for three reasons. You haven't got the real estate to narrow up the pattern. You haven't separated the area enough to not have overlapping areas. And number three, when they're that close in wavelength, they are drastically coupled to each other. When they're drastically coupled to each other, you think you've got two separate feed lines. You really have one. You put a lot of signal into the first antenna, and because they're so closely coupled in space, two-thirds of a watt goes into the second antenna. You think you haven't fed the second one yet. You really have because of the close coupling. So, until you separate them a half wavelength, I say you haven't done anything. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, now, Mel's antenna is a loop. This fellow, this TAC antenna is kind of a spiral. If you're going to phase them, you're telling us, of course, and I agree with you, they should be about 60 feet apart or something like that, would put them about the right distance because of their capture area of each dipole or loop. That's true if you're going to put them together as a, you know, trying to get 3 dB gain out of them, to do it that way. If you're going to phase them as directors on a boom, either antenna, wouldn't that be a quarter of a wavelength instead of a half a wavelength, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, once you start building an antenna for the end fire effect, and once you're building an antenna with, let me pick a number, 8 elements to it, you're building a real Yagi, some of the close-in directors on most designs are 0.1, 0.15 wavelength, relatively close. And you're about to say, are those affected areas of the individual elements, the parasitic elements, are their affected areas overlapping? Yes, they are. And at first you would say, well, the Yagi can't work. There's more going on with the Yagi. When you get into something like an 8-element Yagi, what you think are parasitic elements, which you think are individual dipoles, and you think you're building a end-fire phase array, and there are people who think you're building a 8-element filter with 8 individual tuning structures with some kind of a coupling coefficient between them. You can try to analyze it that way, and it's going to fail. You try to analyze a 8-element Yagi as a filter, it doesn't work. You try to analyze it as a phased array where there's enough separation between the parasitic elements that the affected areas are going to add up. It doesn't work. It is a structure that has a wave going down the boom that travels slower than free space. That's why it's called a slow wave structure. And when that slow wave structure has the right wave velocity at each position along the boom, and you make a plot of that position versus velocity, and it's called a velocity profile plot. When you have the right velocity profile plot, you've made a kind of a magnifying glass. It does focusing of the energy coming in from free space and focuses that energy on the driven element. It's a slightly different phenomena. It's a Huygens principle-like phenomena, a little more difficult to explain. So yeah, you're right. The wavelengths between the elements of a Yagi look awful close, and it looks like it shouldn't work. It's really sort of working by another principle. Is there a clear line where one principle dies and the other takes over? Of course not. There's a big gray zone between the two. That's why I jumped up to an 8-element Yagi to make the point. Is it true with a 2-element Yagi? I am convinced that if you build yourself a 2-element Yagi-like all-driven phased array, 2-element phased array, that you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar at roughly half wavelength of spacing between the 2 elements. You can put 2 elements a tenth of a wavelength apart if you want to. You're not going to get anywhere near as much beam width narrowing, and anywhere near as much gain increase, not anywhere near as much performance. So when it comes to stacking these things, I recommend you move toward stacking half wavelength. Quarter wavelength is not bad, you'll get the performance. A third of a wavelength, better. Half wavelength, you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar. You can go beyond half wavelength if you like. Stack them on full wavelength. You're going to get a narrower beam width. No increase in gain compared to half wavelength stacking. At half wavelength stacking, for most elements like this, the effective capture areas are just kissing each other, just touching. Half wavelength spacing is going to give you the biggest bang. You go beyond that, you get a narrower main lobe, and you think you're getting more gain, but you're getting a stronger side lobe. And the affected areas already are no longer overlapping. There's no more affected area left over. You get no more real gain. So remember, the beam width is a necessary but not sufficient. Every antenna that's got gain has a particular beam width. You can't get around that. But not every antenna with that beam width guarantees it's got that gain. You may have spaced it too far. Your main lobe may be narrow, but if it's too narrow because you spaced too far, doesn't mean you've got more gain. What does that make some sense, Barry? N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay, so you just covered a little gray, a little fuzzy in one place here. The first question was on simple dipoles, or loops, you know, let's call them dipoles for now. If you want to get 3 dB of gain, you should put the dipoles, because of their effective capture area, about a half wave apart. Am I right on that so far?
Yay, verily, right on. You got it, sir.
Okay, but if you're going to use the dipoles as a beam, you're going to have not necessarily a parasitic element, you're going to have a phased element. I'm sure you know where I'm heading with this. What would you consider the right spacing for that?
Now, that's a complicated question. When you're building an end-fire Yagi-like structure, 99% of the people building the structure have A-driven elements and some number of parasitic elements. One of them they tend to call the reflector, the rest of them they call directors. That's a parasitic end-fire Yagi-like structure. Now, the spacing of the elements and the tuning of the elements is your particular chosen Yagi design. And you optimize that Yagi design by going to the computer modeling program called NEC, Mini-NEC, Micro-NEC, YO, Yagi Optimization. You go to one of those Yagi optimization programs. And what is the program doing for you? It is telling you that if you put the elements in these positions in space, and if the elements have these individual tuning frequencies, you have created this particular velocity profile. When you make the right velocity profile, the Yagi phenomena jumps off that page and does exactly what you want. And now if you want me to make it nice and simple as to what is the Yagi phenomena, I've given you some of the ingredients. It's a velocity profile. It's a particular design. But if now you want to make an all-fed Yagi, you're in trouble. To date, most of the attempts of taking a Yagi, where somebody says, gee, I got a beautiful signal I put on the driven element, and if I go and measure the magnitude of the signal that's on all those parasitic elements, in general, they're a hell of a lot smaller. So it looks like I'm not getting all the bang for the dollar. So if I'm smart enough to feed a signal into every one of those parasitic elements as well as the driven element, and now I'm forcing all the signals to be equal in amplitude, and now they're really cranking, and I'm going to get the maximum performance. Good sounding common sense. Every time someone does that, an all-fed array, its gain is kind of yucky. Pretty bad. There's something more going on. When you make an all-fed array, and you try to adjust the amplitudes and the phases just right for the maximum gain, you'll end up with something very close to the amplitudes you would have measured with all those elements being parasitic as part of the Yagi. There is a particular magic velocity profile that gives you the right performance of the end-fire thing that we call Yagi. So feeding all the elements doesn't make it better. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. What is really going on with a Yagi, particularly a young, long Yagi, ain't so easy to explain. It's a refractive optic flow wave structure that gathers energy from a chunk of space considerably larger than what you see when you look down the boom. That 19-element Yagi of mine, the RIW-19 Yagi, gathers energy from a 5.7-foot diameter of space. You look down that boom, and you see elements that are 12 inches long, mounted on a 1-inch diameter piece of aluminum. So you're looking at something that's 12 inches wide, 1 inch high, and it happens to be 13 feet deep, but you don't look that. You don't see that when you look down the boom. If your eyes operated at 432, you would see a black circle in space, 5.7 feet in diameter. And you're about to ask, hey, when that signal is coming down the boom, how does that energy way out there in that 5.7-foot diameter, plus or minus 2.65 feet or whatever it is, 5.7 times 2 divided by 2 is what? 2.25 feet. How does that energy, 2.25 feet above the boom, 2.25 feet to the right of the boom, how does that energy out there know that something is going on where it should start folding itself in and focusing itself on the driven element? How the hell does that energy out there know to do that? That's a tough one. I got some theories on that one, but as you can see, Barry, you make an all-fed phased array in fire, you're probably wasting your time. N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay, I gotta think about that for a while. There might be some advantages to it, predictability or something. But the reason I brought it up was because, especially with the 75-meter little loops, if you try to turn an element into a director or a reflector, parasitic director or reflector, it's kind of hard to do that. You know, what do you make this measurement to? You know, it's a tough call. I think you would tune it some frequency higher, have it resonate a little higher would probably be a clue to it, or lower, you know, to make it a reflector or a director. If it's a driven device, if you have a quarter wave more coax going to this element, it's real easy to predict it. Over.
My mind's going blank. What's the name of this guy who's got this antenna where every one of the elements can be tuned in length electronically?
Oh God, I don't know the name of it either. That's that beam. Mel, what's the name of that beam everybody's buying? Variable adjustment beam thing.
Per antenna.
Twice you started talking before squeezing the switch. So we
Stepper,
IR, yes. Okay, now we remember the antenna. Here, because it's only four element antenna, three element or four element, the exact stacking distance is not super critical. By the time you get out to an eight element Yagi, yeah, you better be close to the right stacking distance of each individual parasitic element if you want full performance. He's only got three or four elements, and it's kind of sloppy. You can get away with murder as long as you do a little bit of retuning. Because he's got the ability to tune reflector, both directors, and driven element, he can decide whether it fires forward or aft. He can decide whether it's got beam broadening or gives it maximum gain. And a beautiful tunable thing, that stepper IR. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, but I'm thinking how we're going to do this in the case of a two-loop 75-meter thing where the two loops are probably going to be like 60 feet apart. I mean, how in the world do you get out there and make these adjustments, you know?
Okay, first of all, if you want full bang out of a pair of elements, simple elements, that's what we're talking about here, although they mechanically look complicated, these are electronically simple elements. They are a subset of a infinitesimal dipole. And if it's on 80 meters, where a half wavelength is 132 feet, and you want full bang for the dollar, and you want the areas not to overlap, you're going to separate them 132 feet. If you're building a 40-meter version, yeah, you're going to separate it 63 feet. So until you separate it that far, you've got overlapping areas and somewhat decreased performance. Now, if you're building a 40-meter version and full performance of 63 feet of stacking, and you've only got 32 feet of stacking, go for it. Instead of getting 3 dB of improvement, you're going to get the 1.8 dB of improvement, and it's still worth fighting for. And by phasing the signal between the two, you can do some electronic steering. If your two elements are side by side, you can steer that beam a whole lot of degrees, but you've got to be careful. Each individual element, fed one at a time, has roughly a 78-degree beam width. A pair of them side by side, at a half wavelength of spacing, is going to have something in the vicinity of a 30-degree beam width. 30 to 35-degree beam width. And that 35-degree beam width, you can now steer it plus or minus more than 60 degrees where the main lobe is. And so you think you're steering the main lobe. Yeah, the main lobe is so broad, you're doing some steering. You're really steering the nulls. And the steering of the nulls allows you to null out either that thunderstorm or that QR Mary or the QR Nancy. And that's worthwhile antenna. And if you vertically stack them, and you've got the altitude of a tower to do it, you can now carefully electronically adjust the takeoff angle and decide I'm going to listen to the F1 layer or the F2 layer today on that triple bounce between here and London, and listen to the one that's got the highest signal-to-noise ratio. That would be a fun antenna, Barry, N2MB, K2LIW.
Yeah, another thing you could actually do with that, with this, because the antennas are very small, you could go from horizontal to vertical polarization with them very quickly. That ought to be interesting.
Because the antenna is so small and so inexpensive as far as your and my resources are concerned, you can either give it a rotator which rotates it to make it horizontal or vertical polarization, or you can build a pair of co-located antennas, one horizontally polarized and one vertically polarized, and switch between the two, or feed them in combination so you get 45 degree polarization if that's what you want. Look at the fun you can have with that, Barry.
Yeah, I'm starting to get a headache just thinking about it. Yeah. And you think that they should be, what did you say you think they should be apart? I think you said 120 feet, but I could be wrong.
Halfway, no matter what band you're on, you get the biggest bang for the dollar at half wavelength. That's where the effective areas are just kissing each other. You can go wider spacing than you want, and it'll give you a little bit of sharper main lobe and a little bit of different steering characteristics, but no more gain. So don't bother. Half wavelength, no matter what band you're on, biggest bang for the dollar is half wavelength. And if you can't stack them at least 0.15 wavelength, don't bother putting two of them. Because they'll be so electronically tightly coupled that you think you're feeding two individual antennas. You feed one and 80% or 75% of the signal gets to the other one anyhow, because they're so electronically tightly coupled. So don't go any less than 0.15 wavelength, rough rule of thumb. If you do, don't bother building two of them. And if you are going to get maximum gain and directivity out of this thing, and you're building a pair of them or more, go for half wavelength if you've got the real estate. So somewhere between 0.15 and 0.5 wavelength is the sweet spot for you. What about you, Barry?
Okay, because 0.15 is really close. I think I know now why these guys are arriving at this distance of about 90 feet for these things. I guess it's bigger than 0.15. It's not quite 0.5, but it's a comfortable spot. That's probably why they're doing it.
You got it. And I didn't even know that that was their recommendation, but I'm very glad that we're re-deriving similar numbers. I can see Bell rolling his eyes now. He wanted to stack a pair of these 5 feet apart. I bet you're a little bit disappointed, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, what is 0.15 on 75 meters, real quick? My calculator's not here. We got to help Mel out on this, really.
Okay, 0.15 versus 0.5. And 0.5 is roughly 135 feet. 40.5, call it 41 feet. If you can't stack them 41 feet, don't bother using two of them. And if you can stack them 135 feet, you're going to get maximum performance. 90 feet is a very nice compromise. Over to you, Barry, and pass it over to Mel.
Do you see that, Mel? 50 feet is reasonable here. You got to do this, buddy. Over to Mel and 2MV.
You know, this is K2KEY. I'd be afraid to do it because I say to myself, gee, after all this work and putting up a full wave movement, and now I start experimenting, and if I have to come up with, you know, I haven't transmitted yet on the receiving movement, this 0.1 wavelength. But what's bothering me, right away, what threw me off on this was that my mouth literally fell open when I made the movement. And I put the AEA analyzer on it. I said, this goddamn thing loads the entire 80 meter band better than any other antenna. No matter where you go on the 80 meter band with the thing, you just give that little variable on the bottom, a little turn this way or that way, and this thing will resonate down to 1:1. And I'm saying to myself, how could this be? Why is this doing this? In other words, I can't achieve this on any antenna outside. There isn't any way you can do this. How can you do this with a loop? Now, what I'm going to do, whether it's going to, one night, if I'm going to try this, take that loop, take it out on the patio deck, which is right outside the main bedroom, the master bedroom, which is the same level as the rest of the room. Put this thing outside out there, and I'm going to... Oh, they're holding their buttons. I'm going to try transmitting with it. And I don't know. This works as well as that whole monster I got up there. But all that resource I put in to put up that full-wave loop, I don't know how I can proceed past that point. How do you explain it to me? How would you put that into words? Because we talked about capture areas, everything. And is it, I can say, so far, it's been performing on receiving as good or better. So am I saying that it's definitely going to do the same thing on transmitting, Dick? Over.
There's a yes and a no to that, Barry. I mean, Mel, stand by a second. In case the machine has to reset. Okay. When you orient that loop on your patio, on your veranda, on your balcony, for the greatest reception, that's not necessarily the orientation that's going to be the best transmission to that particular guy you're talking to in Philadelphia. You may have to do some reorienting, because to get to Philadelphia, you're using the ionosphere, and that ionosphere at HF frequency always has a tremendous amount of Faraday rotation, of polarization, and other phenomena. We all forget that, because it's there day in and day out, we ignore it. You start doing VHF work on moon bounce, on 2 meters, where that Faraday rotation some days allows the signal to bounce off the moon, come back to you with your polarization, and the signal is gangbusters, and you say, boy, I got a system. And you bring over your favorite friends the next day, and you say, I want you to hear some moon bounce echoes. And you press down the key, and you listen, and there's something that's coming back so damn feeble that you hear it just barely, and you're damn disappointed, and he hears nothing. He says, what the hell are you talking about? And that's because between today and yesterday and tomorrow, the Faraday rotation on 2 meters changed just enough that the signal you heard one day was gangbusters, the next day it's almost not there. And Faraday rotation decreases as 1/frequency cubed. By the time you go from 2 meters, 144 megs, all the way down to 3.5 megs, and you cube that difference in frequency, the amount of Faraday rotation you get out of 80 meters, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you did a good, thorough study, you'll find out that that poor signal being launched from Manhattan Beach goes through the ionosphere and twists 3 times before it gets to Philadelphia. I don't know the answer to that, but if somebody told me that, I'd believe it. And so, with a little bit of change in the ionosphere, today it rotates 3 times, tomorrow it's going to rotate 2.5, or 2¾. And that's when you go from east to west, and it does something slightly different when you go west to east. The bottom line of this is, you orient the loop on your balcony for the best performance on reception. You're going to have to reorient it for the best transmission to that friend you're talking to. The easiest way to do that is he feeds it back to you on some other band, or he feeds it back to you on the telephone, and you orient the loop with key down, he's listening CW, and you move the loop back and forth until you get the strongest tone fed back over the telephone. That's one of the easiest ways to do it. But once you do that, I'm almost positive you're going to find out that that inexpensive, tiny little loop is going to outperform your full wavelength, 40-foot high thing.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That you put up with the considerable effort. And you're about to say, what happened to the effective capture area? That big loop has got a beautiful effective capture area that favors a particular set of directions in space and a particular polarization day in and day out. That loop is fixed in where its effective area is, and it's fixed in its polarization. In general, the ionosphere is not favoring that direction and not favoring that polarization. So in general, your full loop, which is not adaptable, cannot adapt to the state of the ionosphere today. That loop has that effective area, your great big loop. But the area is oriented in some direction and some polarization where that buddy of yours from Philadelphia ain't there. So it isn't something wrong with the loop. The only thing wrong with your great big loop is it's not adaptable. Common sense leads you to believe that a full wavelength loop, quarter wave on the side, 63 feet long on the side, and there's 4 of those sides, that much wider in space, looks like it's God, I have more capture area. It doesn't. Ain't that a killer? K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's what bothers me, because I can't change anything on me. See, there was a couple of guys on that have talked about that they have taken these one-way lane routes, and they have devised methods. They have real safety and all, but for it, one guy, he has it in the shape of a diamond. He's explaining he's got tremendous amount of real estate here. He's got 2 125-foot towers separated by 500 some odd feet, and then 2 more towers separated, that hold the other 2 sides of the diamond, separated by like 275 feet. And those 2 towers have winches on them, and he says what he does. He tilts the loop this way and that way, and he says, oh, he can get an amazing amount of gain and whatnot on it. And I'm starting to think now that he most likely has come up with the answer to this situation. But the safety that I'm going to take this thing and make it, that it's going to work even equal to that outside loop, is mind-boggling, Dick. It's just mind-boggling that you take a thing that I should say is that putting them next to each other, you say, where is it? You know, what are you talking about? That little piece of the frame you got there and that thing you got up there? Impossible. Not possible at all. You'd be a fool to stand there and even say that to anybody. They think you're fooling. So they just say, what is this guy, you know, smoking or something? You better cut it out. Because I could say the capture area and all. So even if I put it out there and I adjust it so that it peaks up receiving, and then it's still at even as equal. Never mind taking it into further, but just as equal to the one-way lane loop, I'm going to have an awful time reconciling that thing.
N2MB, I got a question, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to over to you in a second, Barry. When we searched through the attic of my grandmother's farm in the late 40s, my grandfather had in his attic a TRF radio, and I think it was an RCA. I think it was made in the late 20s. A 4-stage TRF. It was in a wooden box, 1.5 feet wide, 1 foot deep, close to 1 foot high. On the front panel of that wooden box were 4 dials. Each dial was 6 inches in diameter, with fine gradations roughly 1 degree all the way around the dial. 4 identical-looking dials, 0 to 360 degrees or something like that, roughly 6 inches in diameter. You open up the wooden lid on this box and you look inside. Each one of those variable capacitors attached to each one of those dials was approximately a 365 picofarad transmitting capacitor. Each one of those capacitors was probably 5 inches deep, 3 inches wide, 3 inches high, maybe 4 inches wide, 4 inches high, 5 inches deep. Great big air variable capacitors, great big spaces between all those huge plates. And so those 4 dials adjusted those 4 great big capacitors on this TRF radio that had about 5 tubes to it. And I think it ran on batteries, but I'm not sure. That was state-of-the-art radio in the mid-20s. And you compare that radio to a modern-day transistor radio, where if it's got a variable capacitor, the variable capacitor is probably a 3/8 of an inch cube and a 365 picofarad. And you would easily say to yourself, well, you can't possibly be getting the Q out of that little bitty variable capacitor. And there's 2 of them in there, by the way, because they even with the modern-day loop stick, you do track the LO and the RF tuning on an AM radio. This is an AM radio. So you compare those 2 radios, a modern-day transistor radio that you can easily put into your shirt pocket versus this thing that filled up a tabletop. And I guarantee they had very close to the same performance, and there's a chance that the modern-day transistor radio sounded and worked better. It's a matter of technology. So you look at that great big full wavelength loop antenna, it looks like it's got to have a lot of area. It's got a lot of wherewithal. and you compare it to this 0.1 wavelength loop of yours, which is fully adaptable, and once you accept the concept of the infinitesimal dipole, let me drop. Once you accept the concept of an infinitesimal dipole, once the dimensions of the antenna are a half wavelength or less in physical space, horizontal, vertical, depth, whatever, once you're under half wavelength, whatever you do to physical size doesn't matter anymore. It's only a matter of, have you built it out of materials that will resonate at your frequency, give you a good impedance match, and not have a lot of resistive laws. As long as you don't violate the laws of resistive laws and VISLA, you've got to get the exact same performance at the tuned frequency, an infinitesimal dipole versus a full halfway dipole. Within half a dB, the exact same performance. Of course, that's a mind blower. The adaptability happens to be more valuable than the physical size. And those guys went through all kinds of winches on great big towers in order to raise and lower this triangular full wavelength loop thing. And I don't think they've got any advantage over you with your balcony-mounted 10th wavelength diameter loop. Except for the fact that their physical phase center might be a different number of feet above the ground. Except for that phenomenon. And you can easily duplicate that. I think they have no advantage over you, Mel. I'll warn you, you go on 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, and you tell those guys that have made that big investment what you've discovered, you're going to be giving them an awful lot of bad news. You're going to be giving them a crazy-sounding story. You're going to get a lot of flack. Are you sure you're willing to fight that particular war, Mel? It's a tough row to hoe. You happen to be right. You got a tough row. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, this is the point. Let's back up a minute. I pick up the ARRL handbook here, and it's full of antennas. Literally, you know how big that book is. It's a dictionary. And you even said that a lot of places you go into where they're professional people and they hide the manual. They don't want to be seen an amateur radio manual on it. They've got dipoles in it. You don't see one mention saying, well, listen, you can put up this halfway dipole for 80 meters, 135 feet long, or if you're not up to that, listen, little frame up, you go over to Home Depot, you buy 12 feet a piece of molding, and you nail it together or screw it together and stick a piece of coax in a condenser and you're in business. They devoted, you look in the manual, they devoted one page to this 0.1 wavelength loop, and it's for 160 meters. You don't see any mention, any reference for receiving or transmitting loops to speak of. It is one or two little mentions. How come? How come in the wisdom of all these years today, as I said, why don't they say, oh, you don't have to bother. You can't put up the 60 some odd feet of wire for 40 meters. Look at it. We got your 5-pound antenna. Or you could build yourself a loop that'll be 3 feet square. Where did this come from, Dick, that we've been in the dark all these years? Is this something all of a sudden that you say that you back in the 20s for some reason it got buried? What happened then? I just say, they devote, out of that book, what is there, 1,000 pages in that book or whatever? I don't think you got more than 3 pages of in anything that has to do with loops, over.
I've got an answer for you, Mel. I am positive 3, 4, 5 times in your life, on television, on burglary, whatever, you have seen that play, Fiddler on the Roof. You know the song Tradition. Can you tell me some of the words of the song called Tradition?
Oh, I don't know. I've heard it. I haven't recently heard it, but yeah. Yeah, true. I don't remember the words. That's for sure. At least it's not this time of night. You'll have me tonight in bed laying there and all of a sudden, It's like sometimes I can't come up with somebody's name and all of a sudden it's in the middle of the night. But the point is that you think the ARRL in all the research, and they put a lot of, a lot of research, a lot of work, a lot of people contributed to that book, including yours truly. Where is all this? Where is this stated? I want to see that this guy states something. He says, listen, you can achieve with 0.1 wavelength antennas, you can achieve phenomenal results. Don't let this be, you know, you tell me about putting delta antennas, putting them in trees, the wire, and all this kind of nonsense, and trying to, you know, stealthy guy, climb onto the roof, you tell the guy last week, if you want to put an antenna and everything. Maybe you can sneak it up onto that building next door. That poor guy's saying, I have no real estate. Why don't we tell him to build a loop thing?
I am hearing Zero myself in my head right now, singing that song. Because what we're saying here, Mel, is so opposite of common sense. Because this little nugget of knowledge is so rare. Every time I talk to 30-year experienced engineers in the antenna engineering field, and I say, what about that chapter in Krauss, and a portion of it is duplicated in the Jasek and Johnson Antenna Engineering Handbook, that chapter about the infinitesimal dipole. Every time I bring up that subject, I get a lot of weird looks from the majority. I don't think one antenna engineer in 10 with 20 or 30 years experience understands that chapter and what it is saying. So, tradition has dominated. Everyone knows an antenna is going to have effective capture area. Effective capture area, in their mind, is a physical thing. Beyond half-wavelength dimension antennas, horns and parabolic dishes and whatever, the area relationship is clear on VHF, UHF antennas. But when you get below half-wavelength, and you resonate it, and the resonating phenomena dominate and generate a physical effective capture area that your eye cannot see, but that radio wave sees. That concept is so foreign to anybody with any horse sense. It's unknown. It could be the absolute constant and its truth, and it's unknown. And if you write an article on this, Mel, you're going to get a lot of flack. Are you sure you want to fight this particular war? You're going to be right. Are you sure you want to be dead right? K2K2R, K2LF.
N2MB.
Okay, Barry, turn to you in 1 second. Well, let me fight the war for 1 minute with this guy here. Because I'm going to blame it on you, Dick. We talked years and years and years about antennas. And we've gone through HF antennas from A to Z and Z to A, back and forth and up and down. Up to 6 months ago, until I brought up this thing that I just happened to have seen coming through the manual, I said, gee, that's interesting. Maybe this is my answer, my voice problem, and some of these other things I hear on 75 that make it impossible. Because up to the time I put that loop together, and a little other gadgets I added to it, of course, with an answer, and all, up to that point, I knew at night, a lot of nights, I couldn't make contact on 75 meters, even with my friend in Pennsylvania, which usually puts in a pretty good signal, because my noise level was 20 over 9. With this loop and all, like I say, I can achieve great receiving. I can take 20 over 9 noise level, bring it down at 5 or so. All the years you and I have been talking and everybody, nobody has ever said anything about this is what I'm saying. Up to 6 months ago, we never even discussed it. So this is what baffles me. There's no reference to it. You never see it. How come the USP then, and they don't overemphasize things? You can get on HF. Here, let me show you. Take the frame and all the things. You can put the thing together in 2 hours. You never see this. It's always, like I say, delta antennas take the wire out. You put it this way, put it up to the gutter, put it down there, put it underneath the eaves. Think, why do it? Put it together this way. This is what mind boggles. And then you're going to tell me it's going to perform as well as that full-wave move outside. That's all. This is it. I guess if I got on the air with this and and it's found that this is what we're talking about tonight, and it's going to be recorded. This is going to be there, and all they're going to say, these guys lost their minds. They don't know what the heck this is. This time they will say. I mean, I've gotten some of those emails, but now I see we're going to get them. I'm going to get them next week. Oh, boy. And you guys are really lost your grip on electronics and antennas. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I was doing something which I think a lot of other people have done. I'm doing mental pictures of wavelengths and antennas while you guys are talking. I'm sort of daydreaming, staring into space, and I come up with a lot of strange anomalies here, and one after the other it started to hit me, so I got to ask you this. First of all, let's take the issue of 3 dB gain realized by two simple dipoles. You space them the half wave apart, that should be about 120 feet. And that should be about the right spacing because of their capture area and all that. And let's say these two dipoles are now vertically polarized, and they're looking broadside to the signal that's coming in, you know, as if they were on a boom. So you would see, if I understand it correctly, if everything was done right, an equal length of feed line coming from these two dipoles, going to a T connector, going to your receiver, impedances withstanding, you should see 3 dB of gain. Correct me if I'm wrong. Am I right at this point? My mental picture is good so far, right?
Absolutely. By the way, you can feed them in fire or broadside, depending on how you phase them. But you've described two vertical dipoles. Let's make one vertically polarized north. One is located more south, 135 feet away. And you intend to send the signal dead east and dead west by feeding them co-phase. Half power to each one. And when you did a receiving test of combining the two versus one, you did get 3 dB on a well-calibrated S-meter. You got half an S-meter, half an S-unit, more signal on reception when you combine the pair versus one all by itself. So far, we're on the same page. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, now that's because at this T-connector, everything, no phase has been changed. Everything is coming in phase. This is happening because the two antennas are exactly the same distance from the transmitting station. If you rotated this thing so that one antenna was in front of the other, in other words, between you and the transmitting station, you haven't changed anything else. You have the equal length of feed line. Now what I see is the first antenna in line, because it's in front of the other antenna, according to what I've just written here, it's 180 degrees in front of the other antenna. Wouldn't that mean that the signal is arriving at that antenna exactly out of phase to the second one? So when you have these pieces of coax coming from these two antennas to this midpoint again, wouldn't they be canceling each other at that point?
Absolutely. Let me let it drop. When you had one single vertical antenna, not counting the angle of takeoff because of altitude above the ground or that kind of jazz, azimuth-wise, you had a 360-degree antenna. You had a pancake antenna. It was a pure vertical dipole in free space. You know, a quarter of a mile away from the space shuttle in orbit. Pure vertical dipole, pancake pattern, 360 degrees in azimuth, and 78 degrees vertical beam width. Very broad pancake. It's a very fat pancake. Once you mounted two antennas side by side, half wavelength apart, and fed them in a co-phase manner, for the first time in your life, when you had one of them north of the other one, one's more north and one's more south, and they're both vertically polarized, they favor east-west, used to have a 360-degree pattern, you now have a beautiful null dead north, you have a beautiful null dead south. Your 360-degree azimuth pattern you used to have just became 35 degrees of azimuth 3 dB beam width.
You didn't change the vertical beam width. You made a huge difference to the horizontal beam width. You changed the beam width.
And that's the gain.
That's one way of looking at the gain. You moved the area. That's another way of looking at the gain. And there's probably a third way. When you're smart enough, all three ways better give you the exact same answer. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, homie, just let it drop. Okay, yeah, so far we're on the same page. This is good. Now, in that known area, in other words, one antenna is in front of the other, between you and the space shuttle. Okay, because they are exactly 180 degrees out of phase, this is why you're getting this cancellation. This is why you're getting this gain. I'm following all this good. Okay, so I want to make some changes now. Remember I said that the signal was getting back to the receiver with equal lengths of coax. So the next thing I want to do is change the length of the coax to one or two, to either one of those antennas, so that the signal now comes in exactly in phase again. What I think we've done is simply electronically steered the pattern. Same gain, same 3 dB, but it's realized now a different way. Is that correct so far?
When it comes to the 3 dB of gain, very, very close. There may be a tenth of a dB of difference. I've got these two vertically polarized half-wave dipoles. One's more north of me, one's more south of me. If I feed them equal lengths of cable, I've got a beam to the east, I've got a beam to the west. I've got a null to the north, I've got a null to the south. If I now add an extra half wavelength of cable to the northern antenna, and this is going to sound opposite of common sense, all phase array antennas fire in the direction of the delay, opposite of common sense. I've added an extra half wavelength of cable to the northern vertical dipole, vertical polarized dipole. I've now got a beautiful main lobe to the north. I've got a beautiful null to the south. Let me double check that. Yes. I've got a null to the south. I've got a main lobe to the north. And my east-west beam has almost disappeared. So far, are you with me?
And so what I'm seeing here is we're seeing more than the 3 dB. Where is the more coming from?
Hold on now. When you fed them equal in phase, you had a broadside 3 dB gain compared to one antenna. When you feed them end fire with the extra quarter wavelength of cable, correction, half wavelength of cable, you still have the 3 dB of beam width north. Where did the extra effective capture area come from, is what you're about to say. The first antenna had a certain effective capture area. The second antenna is directly behind it. Common sense would say it's shadowed by it. It shouldn't be picking up any signal. It is. You're starting to build a two-element Yagi. You're starting to get this velocity profile thing going on. Your area increased compared to one simple dipole. The total area improved. You'll admit that the two antennas, no matter how you feed them, the overall beam width is more narrow. You know that whenever you have more narrow beam width, you have the capability of more gain. I'll admit that in the end fire phenomena, it's more difficult to see where the area is coming from. Take my word for it, it's there. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, so what would you calculate the gain to be now? We have 3 dB because we have these things properly phased, they're not canceling each other, and the increase above the 3 dB, what is it? I mean, how much is it, and how do you see that in the pattern? Now, you said the sides are missing, the front is 3 dB better. I think that's what you said.
That's a roger. I think we've only got about 40 seconds left on the machine. Whether you feed them broadside and get the 3 dB of gain of two antennas versus one, or feed them end fire, in my example where you direct the beam to the north, damn close to 3 dB of gain compared to one antenna. So
you're going to get 3 dB of gain, and you can select in what angle the 3 dB of gain comes from. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, so in other words, whatever arrangement you're telling me, the end result is still 3 dB. We're not getting 4 dB or something like that.
Roger, Dodger.
Okay, now the repeater can time out for the night. Glad to get down. That's what I was thinking when I'm making this mental picture. And yet I've heard, you know, a two-element beam, it's got more than 3 dB gain. So I'm saying to myself, how is this possible? And you tell me it isn't possible.
A three-element all-fired beam. Now if I make a two-element, if I make a two-element Yagi, where one element is fired and the other element is a parasitic element of just the right physical length, electrical length, and just the right position, I'm not sure, but the answer might be a little bit more than 3 dB. Remember, when you take a Yagi-like structure and you feed all the elements, you end up lower gain than when you use them parasitic. Of course that's crazy. That's what everybody keeps rediscovering, Barry.
Okay, so I'm good on this. So, in other words, when it comes to a two-element beam, what you're saying is it really doesn't matter how you do it. You're going to get pretty much the same result.
Roger, Dodger.
I'm talking about, you know, all the elements. I couldn't call them driven. They're all connected, you know.
It's perfectly legal to call it an all-driven array.
I'm starting to realize why you say the all-driven arrays don't perform as well. There's a little more magic to the parasitic, because now you're doing the Yagi unising, and something else is happening here. That's why we're getting more gain.
Give that man a cigar. You've got it. The Yagi phenomenon is a little bit too good to be true. And I think we're about to lose the machine. Good night. Bye-bye, you all. Have a nice week.